Those of us who've been working on environmental issues for many years, including many of you, have realized that if the environmental trends of recent decades continue, that eventually we would be in trouble. What was not clear is what form the trouble would take and when it would come. I now think the trouble is going to come on the food front and within the next couple of years. Indeed, it may already have begun. It has been fashionable in recent years to say that future wars in the Middle East will more likely be fought over water than over oil. And that may be, but it's difficult to win a water war. And what is actually happening is that the competition for water is taking place in world grain markets. Trading in grain futures now is, in a sense, trading in water futures. The second new challenge that farmers are facing is rising temperatures. That for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature during the growing season above the norm, each 1 degree rise in temperature leads to a 10% decline in yields. Wheat, rice, corn.
On February 17, 2004, Lester Brown, founder of the World Watch Institute, spoke at the Environmental Center at the University of Colorado in Boulder. The subject of his presentation was Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble.
On behalf of the sponsors of this evening's lecture, it's my pleasure to welcome you all, the Environmental Center here at the University of Colorado Boulder, Lisa Kaufman, who's done a great job in organizing things here, the Natural Resources Law Center at the Law School here in Boulder, the College of Architecture and Planning, which spans both the campus in Denver and the campus in Boulder, and the Worth Chair in Environmental and Community Development Policy at the University of Colorado Denver, which keeps me in and out of trouble. It's my honor to introduce tonight's distinguished guest lecturer. Lester Brown, for those of us who work on issues surrounding ecological and human sustainability, is certainly one of the most important teachers we will have ever known. I'm confident I'm joined by each and every person who's had the opportunity to either read Mr. Brown's prodigious litany of published work, or better yet, to hear him speak, or engage in conversation with him. As our ears and eyes on the planet, we've relied on his acumen as a scientist, an economist, an agronomist, an anthropologist, any number of ists that I'm undoubtedly leaving out. Perhaps more importantly, as keen an observer as almost anyone could consider. Lester started his career as a farmer by growing tomatoes in southern New Jersey. Degrees in agricultural economics and public administration were followed by work in agriculture, where he discovered one of his mentors, and I was thrilled to learn that he had a mentor or two, Agriculture Secretary Orville Freeman. In 1974, Mr. Brown founded the World Watch Institute, which is well known to all of us, I hope. World Watch served so many so well under Lester's direction. In 2001, Mr. Brown founded the Earth Policy Institute, the mission of which is to provide a vision and roadmap for achieving an environmentally sustainable economy and an ongoing assessment of progress of this global effort. Mr. Brown, who has been famously labeled as one of the world's most influential thinkers, kind of tough label to receive, but Lester is most certainly up to that task. He's also the recipient of over 20 honorary degrees, is a MacArthur Fellow, and is the recipient of too many awards and prizes to mention. Here tonight to address his latest work, Plan B, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble, please join me in welcoming Lester Brown.
Thank you, Heidi, and thank you all for coming out tonight. Heidi was mentioning the newest book, Plan B, Rescuing a Planet Under Stress and a Civilization in Trouble. And it reminded me a bit when I was being introduced some years back by Senator Paul Simon, the late Senator Paul Simon of Illinois. And he held up the latest book and he said, Lester's written the sort of book that once you put it down, you can't pick it up again. I have a friend in Washington who is an amateur masseuse, and she was once telling me that she could put a person to sleep in 15 minutes. And I thought for a minute, and I said, you know, I don't want to demean your skills in any way, but in 15 minutes, I can put a whole room full of people to sleep. The mayor of Trondheim, Norway, was giving a talk a while back. It was an after-dinner talk, and like many politicians, he liked to talk, and he was sort of going on and on. And after a while, even he realized he'd been talking for a long time, so he went to check his watch, and he realized he'd forgotten. He turned to the front row and says, anyone have a watch? And the voice in the back said, what you need is a calendar. Heidi, can I just tell stories tonight? Do I have to? Okay. One more book story. Some of you are old enough to remember Liz Carpenter, who was Mrs. Lyndon Johnson's social secretary. But she also wrote some of LBJ's better speeches. She's a very talented woman, is actually still alive, living in Texas. And after the Johnson years, she wrote a book about her years in the White House entitled Ruffles and Flourishes. And she was on a trip promoting the book, and one night, by chance, met her former White House colleague, Arthur Schlesinger, in a hotel lobby in Atlanta. And she said, you know, it's great to see you, and so forth. And he said, gee, that was a great book of yours, Liz. I've enjoyed it. And who wrote it for you? She said, well, I'm glad you enjoyed it, Arthur. Who read it to you? Those of us who've been working on environmental issues for many years, including many of you, have realized that if the environmental trends of recent decades continue, that eventually we would be in trouble. What was not clear is what form the trouble would take and when it would come. I now think the trouble is going to come on the food front and within the next couple of years. Indeed, it may already have begun. There are two new trends that are making it difficult for the world's farmers to expand production fast enough to keep up with the growth in demand. One of these is falling water tables. The capacity to deplete aquifers is historically very recent. Irrigation, as you know, goes back 6,000 years. But most of this time, the only source of energy we had for pumping water was either animal-driven devices or human-powered devices. And it's almost impossible with muscle power to deplete aquifers. But once you have diesel pumps and powerful electrically-driven pumps, then this becomes an option. And what we're seeing is these pumps have spread around the world at roughly from this country, where we first started seriously pumping underground water back in the 40s, then much more in the 50s. But then these technologies quickly moved around the world. And today there are literally millions and millions of irrigation wells in countries like India and in China. Half of the world's people now live in countries where water tables are falling. And this includes China, India, and the United States, the big three grain producers that account for half the world grain harvest. In China, water tables are falling throughout the northern half of the country, including the North China Plain, which accounts for half of China's wheat harvest and a fifth of its corn. In India, water tables are falling in most states, including the Punjab, which is the breadbasket of India. In this country, water tables are falling throughout the southern Great Plains and throughout the Southwest. But overpumping is now commonplace. Overpumping aquifers to expand food production today almost guarantees a drop in food production tomorrow when the aquifers are depleted. And I don't think we've quite grasped this yet. The water is going to emerge as a major issue. Malthus imprinted on our consciousness the relationship between population and food with his famous treatise that was published just over two centuries ago, 1798, I think it was. What we now need is another Malthus to impress on our consciousness the relationship between population and water. The world's population is projected to expand by 3 billion between now and 2050. The vast majority of the 3 billion to be added will be added in countries where water tables are already falling. Not a good situation. Water scarcity is now crossing national boundaries via the international grain trade. The fastest growing grain market in the world is North Africa and the Middle East. That's Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, the Middle East through Iran. That's the fastest growing grain import market. And the reason for that is that almost every country in the region is pushing against the limits of its water supplies. In order to get enough water for cities, they take irrigation water from agriculture, then import grain to offset this loss of productive capacity. The reason for this is that it takes 1,000 tons of water to produce 1 ton of grain. So if you're facing water shortages, the most efficient way to import water is in the form of grain. The water required to produce the grain imported into North Africa and the Middle East last year is equal to the annual flow of the Nile River. So if you want to visualize the size of the water deficit, it's in that region, it's equal to another Nile River flowing into the region in the form of imported grain. It has been fashionable in recent years to say that future wars in the Middle East will more likely be fought over water than over oil. And that may be, but it's difficult to win a water war. And what is actually happening is that the competition for water is taking place in world grain markets. Trading in grain futures now is, in a sense, trading in water futures. But water shortages are going to play a major role are going to have a major influence on food security in the years ahead. The second new challenge that farmers are facing is rising temperatures. We used to say that the 15, maybe 16 warmest years on record have come since 1980. And that's true, but we can also now also say that the 4 warmest years on record have come in the last 6 years. So the trend is tending to accelerate. If you look at the world temperature chart, 1866 up to the present, you get a very pronounced rise in the last 2 or 3 decades. So temperature is rising. There is now research underway by crop ecologists at the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines and the Agricultural Research Service at the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington that's focusing on the precise relationship between temperature and crop yields. And what they're beginning to realize is, or what they're beginning to evolve, is a rule of thumb. And that rule of thumb is that for each 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature during the growing season, above the norm, each 1 degree rise in temperature leads to a 10% decline in yields. Wheat, rice, corn. In 2002, the year before last, grain harvests were shrunk in both India and the United States because of record heat and drought. We ended that year with a worldwide 93 million ton grain shortfall. Last year, 2003, it was Europe that bore the brunt of the heat. The August heat wave that claimed 14,800 lives in France. That's what? 6 times as many who died when the World Trade Towers went down. 14,800. But that heat wave shrunk grain harvests from France eastward through the Ukraine. Every country in that region suffered or experienced a decline in grain production. Last year, world grain production fell short of consumption by 105 million tons. We've now had 4 consecutive years where grain production has fallen short of consumption. Was 16 million tons, 29 million tons, 93 million tons, 105 million tons. First time we've had 4 grain shortfalls in a row, and the first time we've we've had huge shortfalls like the last 2 years. The result of these grain shortfalls is that we've had to draw world grain stocks down to where they're now at the lowest level in 30 years. The last time they were at this low was when, some of you will remember, when the Soviets secretly cornered the world wheat market after they had a poor harvest. And then we had very tight supplies because they had a poor harvest the next year. That was a time when there was famine in Ethiopia, famine in Bangladesh. Wheat and rice prices doubled there for a period. We're now moving toward a very similar situation. The big question is whether the world's farmers can dig their way out of the hole that we're in this year. I mean, 105 million tons in last year, which this year will be 100. We need 120 million tons above last year's harvest because we have 70 million more people to feed. That takes about 15 million tons of grain per year. I think the chances that the world's farmers can dig out of this hole, keeping in mind they're going to have less irrigation water this year than they had last year. Each year now, the irrigation water supply is less than the year before as more and more wells go dry. And that's happening here in Colorado, too. It's happening in many places in the world at the same time. That's what's so sort of worrisome about this situation. The event that I think is going to trigger this is when China comes into the world grain market for massive imports of grain. Grain production in China in 1950 was about 90 million tons. It increased until peaking in 1998 at 392 million tons. Then it dropped. In the last 5 years, it has dropped from 392 million tons to 322 million tons, a drop of 70 million tons. To put that in perspective, that exceeds the grain harvest of Canada. It also exceeds the grain exports of Canada, Australia, and Argentina combined. So it's not a trivial amount. Now, China has been covering the shortfall in its grain harvest by drawing down its once massive stocks of grain. But it can't go much further now because they only have, they don't have much more than pipeline supplies left. So within the next year or two, China will be turning to the world market for massive quantities of grain, 30, 40, 50 million tons, more than any country has imported in history. When it does so, it will necessarily have to turn to the U.S. because we are the world's largest grain exporter, controlling about almost half of the world's grain exports. Now, this will create a fascinating geopolitical situation because the world's, I mean, what we have is 1.3 billion Chinese consumers who have a $100 billion trade surplus with the United States. Competing with U.S. consumers for our grain, driving up our food prices, and indeed world food prices. That 100 million ton trade surplus China has with the U.S. is enough to buy our entire grain harvest twice. So it's not a question of can they afford to import grain or can they compete? They can't. Now, if this had happened 30 years ago, the U.S. would not have tolerated any country coming into the U.S. grain market and driving up our food prices. But today, we have a stake in a politically stable China. It is the economic engine that's powering the Asian economy. But beyond that, it's the only large economy in the world that's had a full head of steam in recent years. So the whole world is now substantially dependent on the Chinese economy. The next stage is that world grain prices rise and low-income countries that import quite a bit of grain may not be able to import enough grain. And this could lead to political instability. People expect their governments to provide food security, and that may not be possible. Political instability in developing countries could disrupt global economic progress, beginning to affect the Nikkei Index, the Dow Jones 500, etc. Now, while we may be able, we in this room, to absorb some substantial increases in grain prices that translate into higher food prices, when it begins to affect the stock market and overall economic performance, then everyone's affected. So we start with environmental trends, importantly two new ones, falling water tables and rising temperatures. We work that through the economy, the economic effects on food prices, and then political instability, and then global economic progress is disrupted. At that point, we may begin to realize, we may connect enough dots to realize that we can no longer ignore or at least neglect the environmental trends that are undermining our future. This, I think, is going to be the wake-up call. I think it's going to come on the food front and within the next couple of years, and it's probably going to be triggered by China. We're not talking about something that may happen 20 or 30 years from now. This is within the next year or two. There are some things that we can see fairly clearly, others that we can't see so clearly, and the trick in trying to analyze these trends is to know what is clear and what's not. There was a family in Boston visiting a natural history museum, and in the museum was a huge dinosaur skeleton, and the family was looking at it and studying it, and they were trying to figure out how old this dinosaur was, but there was no sign. And so a workman at the museum came through, and so they asked him, they said, "Sir, can you tell us how old this dinosaur is?" And he said, "Yes, this dinosaur is 65 million and 12 years old." And they said, "Wow, how do you know that?" He said, "Well, when I came to work here 12 years ago..." In the field of science, that's known as the law of misplaced precision. You have to be careful. One of the interesting things about the possible link between higher temperatures, shrinking harvests, and raising food prices is that if that happens and the linkage becomes apparent, then we suddenly will have a powerful new lobby for climate change, consumers. And everything could change. One of the things I spend time thinking about is social change and how social change comes. And we use various, we've drawn from various fields, from epidemiology for ecology on things like crossing thresholds and tipping points and so forth. But this could be a historic, could lead to a historic shift in public opinion. And a change in the whole dynamics of what we do about environmental issues, importantly, climate change. The new book is entitled Plan B, the obvious implication being that Plan A is not working very well. Plan A is business as usual. And I think we're in trouble. And I don't think we've yet realized the extent of the trouble. After I'd selected title Plan B, there was Plan B, incidentally, is the name of a relatively new morning after pill. It's quite popular on campuses. So with no apology, I'm riding on that reputation. Warren Hearn is here. Where are you, Warren? Warren knows all about these things. But after I selected the title, there was a cartoon in the New York Times. There was a long conference table and a row of generals sitting here, and then a general up at the end. And the one at the end has a document. It says, "Iraq, Plan B." And one of the generals turns to the one next to him and says, "Was there a Plan A?" Well, for us, there is a Plan A, and it's business as usual, and it's not working. The principal components of Plan B are stabilizing population sooner rather than later, a global full-court press to raise water productivity, much as we did with land productivity a half century ago, and an accelerated effort to stabilize climate. And that means, at least what I propose in the book, is cutting carbon emissions in half by 2015. I'll come back to that. When we look, as I mentioned earlier, at population projections, and we see that the nearly 3 billion people to be added during this half century will be added in countries where water tables are already falling, you can begin to see why we have to think much more seriously about population. Because water is not only important as water, it is the key to future food security. It is one of the keys. The principal constraint on efforts to expand world food production now is not land scarcity, it's water scarcity. There are many places in the world that could produce food if water were available. Coming out of World War II, we looked ahead toward the end of the century and saw enormous growth projected in population during the late 20th century. But there wasn't much new land to bring under the plow. And so we realized that we had to concentrate on raising land productivity. And that meant investing heavily in agricultural research. It meant providing support prices for farmers. I remember negotiating with the Indian government in 1965 about the need to reverse their price policy was a ceiling price policy on wheat and rice and other foodstuffs, catering to urban elites. But the ceiling price was so low that farmers could not afford to invest to improve their land and their production and productivity. So they were locked in this low productivity trap, expecting the U.S. would bail them out if they got in trouble. And when the monsoon failed in 65, we ended up shipping a fifth of the U.S. wheat crop to India to stave off famine. So we have to think about price policy and incidentally, we also created agricultural extension services, farm credit agencies, a whole complex of policies and institutions designed to raise land productivity. And it succeeded. We nearly tripled grain yield per acre from 1950 to the end of the century. Now we have to do the same thing with water. And price policy becomes an important part of that because in much of the world, including this country, water is still treated as though it's an abundant, essentially free resource. Many of the people who use water in the world do not pay very much for it, and some it's free. Some it's even subsidized. So we need to begin pricing water as though it were a scarce resource, which is what it is. And then people will begin to think much more carefully about how they use it. We need 70% of all the water we use in the world is for irrigation. 20% is for industry, and 10% is used for residential purposes. So raising water productivity is going to be one of the keys. I could go into more detail, but I don't want to take the time now. The second thing is population stabilization. If you look at the UN's world population projections, you'll see they have three sets of projections, the low, the medium, and the high. The low projection, I can't remember these precisely, they go something like this. The low projection, world population peaks in about 2042 at 7.4 billion and then begins to decline. So we would add just over a billion between now and when we reach the peak. At the medium level, it goes to, I think, something like 10.4 billion around 1980 and then peaks and begins to decline. At the high level, then it keeps growing through most of the century, peaks around 11.9 billion, as I remember, and then begins to decline. I personally don't think we're going to see an additional 3 billion people. We will not see them either because we get our act together and accelerate the shift to smaller families, or because we fail to, and systems begin to break down and mortality rises, as is happening in Africa now with the HIV epidemic, for example. So I think we have to go for the low trajectory, and that means, one, filling the family planning gap. There may be 130 million women in the world today who want to limit the size of their families and do not have access to family planning services. That, to me, is inexcusable. The second thing we have to do is to create the social conditions that it will accelerate the shift to smaller families. That's education. We know that educating girls is a key to reducing fertility. In every country for which there are data, the more education women have, the fewer children they have. We need basic health care, immunizations for children, things that reduce infant mortality in those countries where infant mortality is still quite high. Jeffrey Sachs, the economist working with WHO, has worked out a plan to provide immunizations for children everywhere, basic sort of rudimentary village-level health care for everyone. And it comes to, I think, a total of $29 billion a year. I cost out the educational one, and then also a school lunch program in the very poorest countries. Because without lunch in school, you're probably not going to get the kids in school. And when they get there, they need to have enough food that they're able to concentrate and to learn. Those three things together come to something like $62 billion a year. Now, $62 billion, part of which would be borne by the U.S., but $62 billion for the international community. Now, that sounds like quite a bit, but it's less than $87 billion. Which is being spent on one country. The third thing we need to do is stabilize climate, and maybe much faster than any of us have realized to date. I personally think that the climate issue is an urgent issue. Let me just give a few examples of the kinds of things we could do to cut carbon emissions in half by 2015. Now, two examples on the demand side. If it becomes important for us to stabilize climate quickly, then we could easily reach an international agreement to phase out all incandescent light bulbs over, the next 3 years. Replace them with a new, highly efficient compact fluorescents. Not a big deal. Entirely doable, and we would make money in the process. The rate of return on replacing incandescent light bulbs with compact fluorescents in most of the world is something like 30% per year. It's difficult to find investments that will return 30% per year, but here's one. If we did that, we could close literally hundreds of coal-fired power plants worldwide. Hundreds. Now, a national example. Heidi drove me over here tonight in her Toyota Prius, but it's last year's model. It's not the efficient one that's out now that gets, 10 more miles per gallon or whatever. But using last year's model, Heidi's, as an example, if we were to raise the efficiency of the U.S. automobile fleet to the level of the Toyota Prius, last year's Toyota Prius, by, say, 2010, we could cut gasoline use in the United States in half. No change in the number of automobiles, no change in the number of miles driven, just doing it more efficiently using a technology that's already on the market. And everyone that I know who has a Toyota Prius is just as pleased as they can be. I also had a ride this morning by chance. Was it Ron Larson in a Honda Insight, which is one of the most fuel-efficient cars in the road, also a hybrid. We have that technology now. I could go on with other examples. And in a town where cutting carbon emissions by 7% by 2012 is thought to, that it'll damage the economy, the idea of cutting carbon emissions in half by 2015 may seem a bit far out, but it's entirely doable if we decide we want to do it. Let me talk a bit on the supply side. I'm going to talk about one source of renewable energy, namely wind. I think wind is going to be become the centerpiece of the new energy economy. In Europe, which is moving much faster than we are with wind, at the end of December, 36 million Europeans were getting their residential electricity from wind farms. That is projected to increase to 195 million by 2020, 16 years from now. That's half of Europe's population. The Europeans aren't any better at this than we are. I mean, we have the technological capacity. Indeed, the wind energy has drawn very heavily on the aerospace industry, which is mostly a U.S. industry. There are six reasons why I think wind is going to be the centerpiece of the new energy economy. One, it's abundant. Two, it's cheap. Three, it's inexhaustible. Four, it's widely distributed. Five, it's clean. Six, it's climate benign. No other energy source has all of these attributes. In 1992, some of you will remember, the Department of Energy did a national wind resource inventory in which they reported that three of the 50 states, North Dakota, Kansas, and Texas, have had enough harnessable wind energy to satisfy national electricity needs. A lot of people said, wow, because I think many thought wind was sort of a marginal energy resource, something on the edge. But looking back, we now know that was a gross underestimate. Advances in wind turbine technology since then have produced turbines that can operate at lower wind speeds, that can convert wind into electricity more efficiently, and that harvest a much larger wind regime. I would guess that in 1992, the average wind turbine was maybe 120 feet tall. Today, the new turbines being installed are 300 feet tall. So you get a disproportionate gain because the wind speeds are higher up here than they are down close to the Earth's surface. I've only done back of the envelope sketches, but my guess is that we can say today that the was that the warning that the battery's about to go? Okay. Are we okay now? Okay.
A little louder.
Okay. Thanks. Forgotten where I was. Where was I? 300 feet high. 300 feet high. I've only done the back of the envelope calculations, but probably whereas we could say in 1992 that these three states had enough harnessable wind energy to satisfy national electricity needs, we can probably say today that these three states have enough harnessable wind energy to satisfy national energy needs. Some time back, I had a call from my son who had been driving on an interstate in West Texas. It might have been I-10, I'm not certain. And he saw there one of the new wind farms that had been built. Texas has invested heavily in wind energy in the last few years. And he said it was interesting because he stopped his car actually to look at it. He said you could see the rows of wind turbines receding toward the horizon. And interspersed among the rows of wind turbines were oil wells. The wind turbines were turning and the oil wells were pumping. And my son said it was the past and the future meeting. He said, I was looking at the energy transition from the age of fossil fuels to renewable energy resources. And I said, you know, if you go back 30 years from now, the wind turbines will probably still be turning, but the oil wells will probably not be pumping. And I think what he was seeing and describing was the energy transition. Wind is now cheap. I'm going to drop this down just a little bit. I think I'm getting a... In the early 1980s, when the modern wind industry was being born in California, the cost of wind-generated electricity from those first wind farms was 38 cents a kilowatt hour. The cost is now down under 4 cents, and there have been some long-term supply contracts signed at 3 cents. A kilowatt hour. The projections are that in many parts of the world by 2010, it will drop below 2 cents a kilowatt hour. That's cheap electricity by anyone's standard. Now, once you get cheap electricity, you have the option of electrolyzing water to produce hydrogen. Hydrogen is the fuel of choice in fuel cell engines, which are coming, but it also is a way of storing and transporting wind energy. You can use it as a backup. And particularly with natural gas prices spiking as they are now, and with the future prices being so uncertain, and we have a lot of natural gas fired generating capacity, you could use wind very well with this, using natural gas as the backup when the wind ebbs. So we're looking at wind being used to produce hydrogen. Now, we don't have to wait for fuel cells. If it becomes important, we can convert any internal combustion engine that burns gasoline will also burn hydrogen. I mean, if you're in Tokyo, all the taxis burn methane, for example, for clean air purposes. You can get kits to convert a gasoline burning engine to hydrogen if you're interested in doing that. So we're now opening up a whole new field of energy. We have the technologies that set the stage for a new energy economy. The first country in the world to have a plan to convert from fossil fuels to renewable energy entirely to a hydrogen-based economy is Iceland. A consortium of companies working with the Icelandic government have already begun the process of converting. Right now, Daimler Chrysler is converting the buses in Reykjavik, the capital, to fuel cells. Shell has already built, using cheap hydroelectricity to electrolyze water and produce hydrogen, has opened the service station at the bus terminal where they refuel the buses. Once they finish the bus fleet, then they begin concentrating automobiles. Then the next stage is the fishing fleet. That's the big industry in Iceland, and installing fuel cells and hydrogen facilities on the ships. Now, Iceland, as you may or may not know, already gets most of its heating from geothermal energy. Almost all the buildings in Iceland, probably 85%, are heated with geothermal energy. So they have geothermal, they have hydro, and they're going to make the conversion to. So it's entirely doable. We're beginning to see what it might look like. Now, one of the things we have to think about is making the creating the hydrogen infrastructure. And you hear estimates from especially industry sources, it's going to take decades, a half century, it's going to cost a bunch of money, and so on and so forth. It's not easy, but it's not that difficult either. You need two things to produce hydrogen. You need electricity, preferably cheap electricity, and water. Every service station in the United States has electricity and water. The other thing you need, beyond a hydrogen generator, which is a century-old technology, it's very simple, you need a compressor, because hydrogen by nature is a very voluminous gas, and you have to squeeze it down so you can get enough in the tank in a car that you can drive for 300 or 400 miles. But it's entirely doable. In our office, we have a small solar cell, about 4 by 6 inches. We have that hooked up to a small hydrogen generator. You can hold it in your hands. It's not very big. And the electricity from the solar cell breaks down the water in the hydrogen generator, produces hydrogen and oxygen. The hydrogen then goes into a small fuel cell and generates electricity, and that runs a fan. Now, this is not the way I do it in the real world, but when we have a press conference or set this up to demonstrate, our receptionist operates it. She assembles it and operates it. She's not an engineer. The only point I want to make is these are not mysterious technologies. They're entirely understandable. We start with sunlight, and we end up with a fan running off a fuel cell. Now, one of the questions is, how can we quickly restructure the global economy, especially the energy economy? And I think the key is getting the price right, getting the market to tell the ecological truth. A model for this is provided by the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. They published about a year and a half ago a study on the social cost of cigarette smoking in the United States. They took into account two costs, the cost of treating smoking-related illnesses and the losses of worker productivity from smoking-related illnesses. And their conclusion was that the cost to society of smoking a pack of cigarettes is $7.18. One pack of cigarettes, $7.18. Now, this does not include the cost of growing the tobacco, manufacturing the cigarettes, and marketing. This is just the cost to society. These are real. Someone bears these costs. It may be the worker. It may be the employer. It may be taxpayers underwriting Medicare. But the costs are real. Someone pays these costs. Now, the interesting question is, if it costs society $7.18 for each pack of cigarette smoke, what's the cost to society of a gallon of gasoline burned? And the answer is, we don't know. We haven't really done the work yet. And in part, it's because we're dealing with future things, whereas CDC was dealing with past epidemiological history to make these estimates, and they did a very good job of it. Some of the effects of climate change can be very abrupt. For example, in recent months, there's been a lot of discussion about how ice melting in the Arctic Sea may lead to a shift in ocean currents in the North Atlantic. The Gulf Stream now goes up the east coast of the United States, the east coast of Canada, turns east just south of Greenland, comes across and down the coast of Europe, and then the coast of Africa, and continues south. Now, the risk is that that could change. Instead of going all the way up near Greenland and going across, it would take a shortcut because of the changes in the dynamics of ocean currents. If that happens, the climate of Western Europe will be much more like that of Siberia than of Western Europe today. Siberia is in the same latitude. Agriculture will change entirely. Another example, the World Bank has published a map of Bangladesh with a 1 meter rise in sea level. Bangladesh loses half its rice land, and 40 million people are displaced. Now, where do you move 40 million people in Bangladesh, already one of the most populated countries in the world? What country would take even a million sea-level refugees? I mention these examples because we may soon conclude that the costs of climate change are unacceptably high. And the key to restructuring the economy is restructuring the tax system. Reduce income taxes and increase the tax on carbon. No change in tax levels. Reduce income taxes, increase the carbon tax. Not a big deal. I think it was Øystein Dahle, the former vice president of Exxon for Norway and the North Sea, now retired from there, who actually took my place as chairman of the board of the World Watch Institute, who said socialism collapsed because it did not allow the market to tell the economic truth. Capitalism may collapse because it does not allow the market to tell the ecological truth. And this, I think, is the challenge. Decision makers making economic decisions take their cues from the market. Whether we're consumers, corporate planners, government policymakers, investment bankers, we make decisions based on the price signals that the market gives us. But if the market's giving us the wrong signals, we're not going to make good decisions. And that, I think, is what's happening now. So this is the challenge. To wrap up, one of the questions I asked myself as I was preparing to write, as I was doing the research for Plan B, was, can we restructure the energy economy quickly if it becomes important to do so? And I went back and read some of the economic history of World War II. And in particular, President Roosevelt's State of the Union address, January 6, 1942. This is 1 month after December 7, 1941. And in this, he laid out the arms production goals. He said, we're going to produce 45,000 tanks, 60,000 planes, 20,000 artillery guns, 2 million tons of shipping. All that shipping because suddenly we're faced with an enormous logistical challenge of fighting two major wars on the far side of two oceans. Roosevelt and his colleagues knew that At that time, the U.S. automobile industry represented the largest concentration of industrial power in the world. Even during the Depression, they'd been producing 3 or 4 million cars a year. So after he laid out these arms production goals, he called in the leaders of the industry. And he said, you know, you guys control much of this country's industrial capacity, so we're going to depend heavily on you to help reach these arms production goals. And they said, well, Mr. President, we're going to do everything we can. But this is going to be a real stretch, producing cars and all these arms, too. He said, you don't understand. We're going to ban the sale of automobiles in the United States. We're going to ban the sale of private automobiles in the United States. From the beginning of April 1942 until the end of 1944, there were essentially no cars produced in the United States. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to remember that now. I mean, it's hard to realize that one could do something like that. That's exactly what they did. We exceeded every one of those arms production goals. In thinking about priorities, I looked at our budget. And when I was doing Plan B, I was looking at the defense budget for 2002, $343 billion. Then I compared it with other countries. We spend more for defense than all of our NATO allies combined, plus Russia, plus China, and if you want, you can throw in the evil Axis as well. The late retired Admiral Eugene Carroll said about a year ago, he said, for 50 years we were in an arms race with the Soviet Union. Now we're in an arms race with ourselves. I think it's time to rethink. If our interest is security, global security, and national security, I think we probably should be reordering our priorities a bit. Since September 11th, the world's political leaders and the communications media have been preoccupied with terrorism. I'm particularly aware of this because on September 11th, 2001, I was in New York City to give a luncheon talk at the New York Times on the latest book, the one before Plan B, Eco-Economy, Building an Economy for the Earth. Needless to say, that lunch never took place. But what I've realized in thinking about this since is that if Osama bin Laden and his colleagues succeed in diverting our attention from the environmental issues, from the environmental trends that are undermining our future, they may reach their goals for reasons that even they did not imagine.
I'm an advocate for biodiesel, and I'd like to first congratulate every student here for voting in biodiesel. The whole university is running on biodiesel blends. I'd like to hear your opinion on how to balance, not so much in the U.S., but in developing countries where you talked a lot about food production, how do you balance the ability to take land, agricultural land, out of food production and into the production of seed crop, oil seed crops for biodiesel production or corn for ethanol production versus keeping it in food?
Right. If the food situation tightens, as I think it will, then it's going to become much more difficult to continue using agricultural capacity to produce fuel for automobiles. And the economics probably will not favor that over the long term. For example, a farmer in Iowa who has a quarter acre of land that's leased to the local utility to site a large wind turbine can earn from that quarter acre $2,000 or $3,000 a year. If that quarter acre is used to produce ethanol, say 40 bushels, 2.5 gallons per bushel, 100 bushels, 100 gallons of ethanol at $1.20 or $1.50, say that's $150. But that wind turbine on that same area will produce more than $100,000 worth of electricity. Or if you look at it, and so my guess is that over time we're going to have to use all the biological capacity we have for food and we'll turn to these other sources for energy. For example, A cornfield in Iowa converts probably at most 1.5% of incoming solar energy in the course of a year into biochemical energy, which is what you need for ethanol or for to produce corn generally. Solar cells convert between 15 and 18, maybe even 20% of incoming sunlight into electricity. So I think over time we're going to be driven toward the mechanical sources of energy as opposed to the biological ones. I think we're going to need all the biochemical energy and food to support ourselves, probably.
We've got one with a microphone. I think he's okay. And then we'll go
to
that.
You talked about the devastation to vegetation by cattle and talked about the shortage of grain and water. Most of the grain and water is used to feed cattle. How come you didn't mention vegetarianism?
There are a lot of things I didn't mention tonight. It has been traditional to think, indeed I've thought myself, that it's very inefficient to convert grain into animal protein. Okay? If you look at the efficiency ratios, cattle in the feedlot, it takes about 7 pounds of concentrate to get 1 pound of live weight. For pork, it's maybe 3.5 pounds of grain concentrate per pound of live weight. For poultry, it's about 2.2 to 1. For catfish, it's about 1.7 pounds of concentrate for a pound of live weight. Okay? So clearly, poultry and catfish are more efficient. Now, if you use land in the Corn Belt, which is where we grow most of our corn and soybeans, you can get 140 bushels of corn or 35 bushels of soybean. Now, if you want high-quality protein, you can consume the soy protein directly. I mean, I always have some tofu in my refrigerator, for example, which I mix in with various things and use in various ways. But if the choice is between corn and soybeans and using the corn to produce poultry or eggs or catfish, then it's more efficient to grow corn than it is to grow soybeans and consume directly. So it's not as clear as I think most people used to think. You actually have to go through the source of high-quality protein, whether it be soybean on one hand, and compare it with beef and pork and poultry and catfish to see how the efficiency gains fall. There are other reasons for consuming less livestock products than simply being a vegetarian. One is it's most of us are living too high on the food chain for our own health.
This has been a Virtual Renderings production.